Remakers Mark Special Episode 15, In Memoriam 2015. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Remakers Mark. Here we are in our 15th special episode where we are once again celebrating those who we lost in 2015. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks, Jeremy Nelson, Lee Honorable Mention, and Mark Josting. So we have done this 2 years prior, 2013 and 2014, and while we're not happy to do so, we are happy to celebrate the lives of those who passed away in 2015 and in and around Hollywood. Andy is going to be hosting this. He tends to be sort of our death barometer? I don't know.
I am your Vincent Price.
Yes, he tends to be our Vincent Price in that he's the one that usually notifies us first. I don't know if he has like a particular RSS feed that he subscribes to or what, but it's kind of eerie. I don't know. Maybe he's got like a police scanner for the afterlife.
You guys don't?
That's also creepy. Anyways, I'm going to hand this over to Andy now. He is going to host it. We're going to do five a little bit longer picks, a few minutes there, and then we're going to have a couple guest picks, and then we're going to do some shorter picks to round it off. So, Andy, I hand it off to you.
This would be a great place to insert that Vincent Price laugh from Thriller.
Okay.
If you want.
I don't really care. Got it.
Thank you, Kyle. We're going to talk about dead people, famous dead people. People that we think were important to the world of pop culture that we lost. We're going to, as Kyle said, talk about someone a little bit at length and then a quick lightning round to wrap things up. We will start with Jer, who I believe is going to talk about someone that I actually didn't realize passed away in 2015, but is also one of my favorite comedians.
Thank you, Andy. April 7th of 2015, he died of pneumonia. And he is one of my...
he being whom?
He being Stan Freberg, comedian, radio personality, television personality, writer, satirist, as I later found out, also a puppeteer and among many other things. But I knew of Stan Freberg from a lot of his old radio spots back in the 60s and 70s, probably most notably or most famously one called St. George and the Dragonette, which is a spoof of Dragnet, the TV show. And I'm pretty sure it's on YouTube, so you could probably put that link in. But he was also in a lot of commercials, found himself into bit parts in a lot of movies and TV shows back in the 60s and 70s. And he had such a unique voice that he did a lot of voice acting in animation and cartoons, kind of in that golden age of that era with Warner Brothers and Disney and all of the other minor studios beyond those two that had cartoons coming out back in the 50s and 60s. Interesting little tidbit of information is that George Lucas actually asked Stan Freberg to be the voice actor for C-3PO.
Oh, really?
And Stan Freberg actually said, you should just let Anthony Daniels use his own voice.
Wow.
So we have the C-3PO that we have, but it could have been Stan Freberg, which if you listen to Stan Freberg's voice, makes it an entirely different character.
And that might have made C-3PO more along the original intended lines of like the used car salesman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, I guess I don't have a ton to say about him besides the fact that growing up back in middle school and high school, I used to listen to the Dr. Demento show in the middle of the night on Saturdays. And it was, which is an old radio show that was on that just played comedy bits and music and was the discoverer of Weird Al Yankovic and pulled a lot of things from old radio dramas and radio comedies and things. And that's where I kind of found Stan Freberg and I heard him a lot on that and made me want to go back and listen to more of him and kind of find out what, you know, what else there was that he had done. And turns out he's done a whole mess of stuff all over the place. So he's just always been, I've got a couple of his LPs and some vinyl of his that I found in some radio or some used stores that I listen to every once in a while. It's just, it's a clever, witty kind of comedy, and it is pure old radio comedy with the great Foley and just him doing two or three different voices, and He's just he's a kind of comedian that we don't have anymore. And he was doing comedy all the way up until his 80s. He was in the biz 70 years.
Wow.
Which is unheard of. I mean, especially when you look at how different comedy was back then to now, and he was still doing stuff. So, Stan Freeberg is who I'd kick us off with.
I had my dad had one of his records that I recall listening to as a kid. I think it was either just called The United States of America or The History of the United States of America, starting with Columbus and up to, I forget where it ended, but I remember thinking even back then that it was riotously funny.
Yeah, that was Stan Freeberg Presents The United States of America. Yeah. That's probably the second most notable thing most famous thing that he's got. Yeah, it's good.
It was wonderful.
Nice. I know the name, but I don't know his stuff. But now I really, really want to seek it out. Or maybe, I mean, I've heard some Dr. Demento shows, but I don't remember him specifically. So I will need to remedy that.
You probably know more of him than you realize.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah. Cool. He's one of those guys that through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, he had his hands in so many different things and was part of so many different projects that I'm sure that you have been affected by him, if not knowingly. Which is what I want people to say about me.
There you go.
That's a nice way to go.
I like it.
Yeah.
For your Yula Googly.
Yep. He affected me, even though I didn't even know it.
And Zooland. Oh, nice Vincent Price laugh.
I'm sensing a theme here.
All right. Thanks, Jer. That was really, really lovely. Just going to say that.
thanks, Ann.
Hey, I do this hosting thing once a year, okay?
You're doing great.
Thank you. I'm up next. I'm going to speak of Mr. Leonard Nimoy, who passed away this past year. I believe he was 83. If you don't know Leonard Nimoy, how are you even listening to this podcast? I mean, let's be honest.
Yep.
but just assuming that you don't know who he was, he is most famous for his portrayal of Mr. Spock from the Star Trek franchise. He actually did quite a bit of other stuff, but you likely wouldn't know it unless you were a student of B and C quality sci-fi from the 50s and early 60s, or were a big proponent of theater in the in the 70s, because that's kind of where he also was very active.
I didn't really beat poetry.
Was a beat poet, had some spoken word and musical albums that were kind of based on the character of Spock, and some weren't. Was also a very very accomplished photographer, and actually considered after the Star Trek television series was over of just kind of quitting acting and going into professional photography, and a really good movie director. I was kind of surprised to learn at how much he had it directed. I remember hearing at one point that he had done a couple of the Star Trek movies. He did Star Trek 3 and 4, which was Star Trek 3 was The Search for Spock, and Star Trek 4 was The Voyage Home. And then also directed, I didn't realize this, Three Men and a Baby. Did you guys know that?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Huh. Yeah. What? Really? I know. Mind blown, right? Which I think is a fantastic movie.
The only other thing that I really know him from was he was the voice of Galvatron in the Transformers movie that came out in 1986.
Yep. Yeah,
yep.
Sure
yep.
was.
Yep.
And he sang a song about Bilbo.
He did.
Mm-hmm. Bilbo Baggins. You have to look up that song. It's amazing.
Yes. It is.
Okay, in I'll, every we'll, way.
Please link
we'll
to
link
it.
To it in the show notes. Yeah, we'll embed it. Yep.
Awesome. And then he's been a writer, a musician, all of this stuff. He's written a couple of autobiographies, the first one entitled I Am Not Spock, followed up 20 years later with I Am Spock. and then his last appearance on film was actually as Spock in the rebooted Star Trek movies directed by J.J. Abrams.
Yeah, Spock Prime.
Yeah. And while I would say I'm a Star Trek fan, I wouldn't call myself a Trekkie. As I read, who was it? I think internet friend Sean Tubridi put once a quote that I don't know if he generated it or if he was just passing it along, but I thought it was great. It said, "My head belongs to Star Trek, but my heart belongs to Star Wars," which I thought was pretty great. But the character of Spock, and it's unfortunate that people summarize his entire career in one character when really he did so much more. But the reality is that's his most well-known role. But the character of Spock, I think, has become to a lot of people this kind of beacon or, I don't want to say hero might be a little strong of a term, but
like a spirit guide.
Kind of, yeah. This is a character who was logical to a fault. I mean, that was kind of the characteristic of the Vulcans, but I think people now have interpreted some mental health kind of aspects onto the character, or not maybe mental health, but just some other aspects, like maybe that he displayed some tendencies of autism and things like this, that he was able for some people to relate to this character as showing how that could be a powerful, positive character, how he could do well despite these kind of differences from other people. And I've heard him interviewed, Leonard Nimoy interviewed several times, and I've always been very impressed with him, that he seems to be a very gracious interviewer. He knows he's getting old. I mean, can you imagine how many times he's been asked about being Spock? I mean, come on. And and he always seems to be very gracious about it, never seems to get sick of those questions, is willing to answer those questions, and seems to understand the importance that character had to so many people. And I appreciate that he realized maybe it took a while to get there for him, because I know if people kept asking me that same thing, it would drive me crazy. But to realize how important that was, like that it was bigger than him, that he was simply this kind of, you know, conduit for this character. And I want to also just make a little mention of Alan Rickman, who passed away just recently as of the time of this recording, played in the movie Galaxy Quest a character who was a very much a spoof of Spock. And I would like to think that it was, the whole movie is kind of an homage to Star Trek, but that this character definitely was, I would say, an homage to Spock. And
yeah,
I just thought it was a great character. I think that actor kind of goes along a similar arc, realizing that this character is bigger than he is and is very, very important, and actually has a lot of value. That it's just a wonderful movie. And I also like Alan Rickman, and I'm sad he's gone too.
Yeah, to them.
So
yeah, we're going to have a lot to say about him next year.
Oh man.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I last encountered, aside from Spock Prime in the first Star Trek reboot, I last encountered him in Fringe, where he plays kind of the buddy to one of the main scientists, who is played by the gentleman that played the king in Return of the King, whose name I can't remember and I'm ashamed of it. Anyways, he was Spockish. I mean, Leonard Nimoy is kind of always Spockish, right? That's kind of his thing. But he did very well in that, and you know, he did a little action in it, which was kind of fun, and he made some good cameos every now and again. And he just, you know, I thought he added a lot of good gravity to that series when it needed it. So
yeah,
I thought that was very good too.
All right, moving on to Mark. Mark is going to talk about someone who was an actor, but really was more of a musician. Mark, tell us who you got.
Well, I'm going to be talking about B.B. King. At the top of his IMDb credits would be his appearance in the movie Spies Like Us.
Yes! Awesome. How many other credits are there? I'm just curious.
I don't know. I didn't even bother. And it's because B.B. King is not really known as an actor. Of course, he's known as a guitarist, a blues man. One of the giants of the field of blues music, and just one of the giants of guitar in general. He's one of the people that really defined a genre. In the genre of blues, you can also mention like Robert Johnson, and you can mention Jimi Hendrix. Not a lot of people are up there hanging with B.B. King. What's really fascinating to me is that B.B. King was not really that complete of a guitarist. He, by his own admission, you know, he didn't do chords.
Yeah,
he was basically Johnny B. Goode. You know, he played just naturally by feel, and that was all. He made, he did incredible things. He made his guitars sing. Like his guitar was a second voice for him, and his style was just these really sweet single note licks. It was just so expressive and just jam packed with life in every phrase. But if you want to talk academics, they're just not there for the guitar. He's really unique as a blues guy that, especially in Delta blues, which is, you know, where he came from. He was born in Mississippi and kind of brought up on Robert Johnson. The other blues guys in the genre are the guys that are kind of singer songwriters. You know, they're playing their guitar, they're playing full chords, they're making, they're drawing melodies out in playing two or three parts on the guitar, and singing at the same time. And that's not something that B.B. King could do. But if you ask him to emote with his guitar, like, almost nobody could do that better.
Yep. Like, what he did was what I knew blues to be aside from the Robert Johnson school, which was a band playing in the back, a blues singer saying something, and then playing a call and response riff in it. And mm-hmm. I didn't know, I mean, he essentially invented that style, which is, what pretty much defines blues guitar now. He invented that. And I had no idea until I knew he was a big figure, but I didn't know quite to that extent. I mean, he basically invented modern blues as it is today.
Yeah. And it's an excellent point that a lot of the, like you mentioned, the Robert Johnson school, the guys that are singing with just them and their guitar, a lot of that stuff is just kind of out of necessity that, that these are guys that, they scrimp and save for years and years to buy the cheapest guitar, used guitar at the store. And that's what they have available to them. So they're making music on their one instrument. B.B. King was always backed by a band. And so he did do that call and response where, he featured both his singing voice and his guitar's singing voice. Lucille was her name, by the way. It's just a fun fact. B.B. King's first guitar was Lucille. And then every guitar after that, he also named Lucille. But yeah, that's an excellent point that the blues wasn't the same after B.B. King because he did it differently. And just like the guys before him, they did it the way they did it out of necessity. So did B.B. King. But he brought so much life out of the way that he did it. Just listening to those licks, they're so sweet.
Yeah.
They're just beautiful. So yeah, that's B.B. King, man. It's the world of guitar is going to miss him.
Yeah.
I agree.
For sure.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Let's move on to Lee. And Lee, tell us who you're going to talk about.
Well, I'm going to talk about somebody who, when I was a kid, was responsible for a lot of nightmares. and that was Wes Craven. I thought
it was maybe like Bob Ross or something like that.
Yeah. Him too. But some of his earlier work, like Last House on the Left, Swamp Thing and The Hills Have Eyes, I never saw those. I was introduced to his work with A Nightmare on Elm Street, the first one. And I remember watching the scene, the first death scene, and being so unnerved by that I couldn't watch the rest of it. And I really, truly did have trouble sleeping for a while. So that's the kind of effect that his work had on me early on. I think I was, 12 at the time. But then as I got older, I watched more of his movies, like the subsequent Nightmare on Elm Street movies, 2, 3, 4, 5. I saw all those. I was actually able to sit through all those. 2 is terrible, by the way. It's a complete waste of your time. Don't even watch it. 3 is, in my opinion, the best of the franchise. It's a very interesting story. Later on, movies like Shocker, and then, of course, the Scream franchise, which the funny thing about Scream is when I went to see that in the theater, I was in school, and my roommate and I were going to come up to the Mall of America to see the re-released Star Wars Episode 4. And in 3 theaters, the movie was playing and it was all sold out by noon. So we couldn't go see that. So we were like, well, we came all this way. Let's see a movie. So we saw Scream, not really knowing what it was. and being really pleasantly surprised by it. I didn't know what to expect, and it was the first horror movie that put the horror movie genre in the spotlight, and I thought that was pretty genius. And I really enjoy that movie. That might be the movie of his that I enjoy the most.
It's very enjoyable. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a fun horror movie. But then other, you know, movies like Serpent and the Rainbow. I remember seeing that like on HBO in like 1988 or something like that. And I thought that was really interesting too. But yeah, as far as I think for the Scream movies, I think he did all of those. The Nightmare on Elm Street movies, he did the first and the last ones, for, you know, reasons of, I think, studio politics. He wasn't involved in the other ones, but, yeah, I think he's one of those directors, you know, up there with like John Carpenter and, George Romero. You know, I think he's up there with those guys in terms of, you know, really defining the horror genre and being responsible for where it is today. And I think he's influenced a lot of other directors as well. So, yeah, hated him when I was a kid, and I love him now.
I have two totally outlandish things to say about this, both of which are probably totally outlandish, but I'm still going to go with them. One is that... you know, I don't know if you guys are as big of Apple nerds as I am. I know most of you are, but when Apple introduced the iPhone, Steve Jobs came on stage and started saying things that were that could have been hyperbole, but were actually 100% true, which is like, if you're lucky in your life, you get to work on one thing that kind of changes your universe, whether that's a particular type of product, a particular genre, what have you. And, you know, Apple has done it, you know, two or three times with the original Apple, the Mac, and then the iPod, and now they were announcing the iPhone, which did that as well. It's pretty rare when someone can define a genre and redefine a genre, so much so that after the redefinition of the genre with Scream, it didn't mean that traditional horror movies didn't exist, but you looked at them differently because the lens of Scream... You looked at all horror movies through that lens after that. And that could be said for bad with kind of the cynicism of that age of that. But I think it's mostly just that it kind of put a meta narrative on top of a genre that really needed that. And I think it made it really, really interesting as a genre again, after sort of being stale and stagnant for a long time. The second outlandish thing is that I'm wondering how much he has to, how much he should take credit for sort of the Game of Thrones-ish willingness to kill off major characters, in that Drew Barrymore is in the first scene of Scream, and he kills her off. She's the first thing, and you're like, whoa, okay. Like, I know nothing about this movie, but like a pretty decent sized name, you know, I mean, obviously a very recognizable actress. Like, where's it going to go if the name on the poster, like the main face on the poster, gets killed off in the first 7 minutes? And I think there's been a lot of shows, genres that have you that, that have done that since then. So good on you, Wes, for, you know, upending everything in a lot of great ways.
Mm-hmm. I think what that I was like, a, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, what I like about Wes Craven as a director is that you watched him evolve with the genre, and he very rarely did he go outside of the genre. Like, he is a genre director and writer. I mean, that's horror was what he did, but you watched him evolve as the genre evolved, and to get to a point where he wrote Scream and decided or made a movie in a time where the people in the movie grew up watching more or less his horror movies. So they are aware, they come from a place where they know that horror movies exist. And there are these tropes that happen in horror movies. And then to play off of that, instead of lampooning it and making fun of it, to actually use it to his advantage and to redefine the genre while almost making fun of it, but not quite. I mean, that takes some chops as a director and as a writer to kind of go through, realizing that I'm making a movie that presupposes that all of the characters in it already know about all of my other movies.
Yeah.
Which is pretty bold.
And then, brilliant, mm, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing that I was going to say is that his early stuff, Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes, I mean, those were some of his first movies where he wrote and directed. I mean, I think they might have actually been his first couple of movies, but they are genre redefining in and of themselves in a completely different way. I never had really liked him because I don't like the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. But then the more that I got into horror movies, the more I realized just how much he's got going on with the genre and how much he has affected it and how much good stuff he's done besides that franchise.
Yeah. I have not seen The Last House on the Left, but from what I've read about it, I don't think I want to see it.
It's brutal.
Yeah, it is. Looks really,
it's
really
visceral, and it's nothing I ever want to see again. And yeah, that is kudos to him and what he did with that to make a movie that is so unnerving that it sticks with you to that degree.
Yeah. Yep. But that was my guy, Wes Craven.
All right. I have to admit, I know very little about Wes Craven. I don't really have much to add to that because I'm just not a horror movie guy, and I just never have gotten into those. So, but I trust the rest of your opinions. So, good
job. You're here.
Good job, Wes Craven. finally, for the last of the longer discussions, Kyle, you're going to speak to someone who I think is responsible for something that we all love very much.
Indeed. So this year we lost Sam Simon, who is known by most as one of the co-creators of The Simpsons, along with Matt Groening and James L. Brooks. They founded it together. It was ultimately Matt Groening's sort of vision, but in reading about his involvement with it, he assembled the show's first writing team. He co-wrote 8 episodes, and basically everybody that interviewed him basically said that The Simpsons' heart and the way that it puts characters first versus stories first, or at least did in kind of its prime, you know, in the best years of its life, is entirely due to Sam Simon. So he would ask questions about, you know, why is this character doing that? What is their motivation, right? So things that I think before in animation, people didn't really do that, you know? I mean, I think Walt Disney films did, but I think in animated television, it was cartoons, and it didn't have that weight. And it's not like they were making, you know, like an animated Law and Order ultra serious thing, but he wanted there to be heart behind it. And
that would be awful.
Because of that, I don't know, I'm kind of intrigued. He ultimately was the one who made sure that these were interesting characters, that these were real, you know, human characters, even if they were yellow humans with 4 fingers on their hands. Right. And because of that, The Simpsons became what it was, which was a beloved show with beloved characters that got to the core of so many things for so many people. So he really is responsible for what The Simpsons is best known as in its prime time. He was only aboard for, I think, 4 years from 89 to 93. He and Groening, while they created it together, were butting heads all the time. Groening is notoriously hard to work with, and Sam Simon is pretty stubborn from what I've been reading. And he left and, you know, made tens of millions of dollars in doing that. He went on to do more in Hollywood, but nothing huge. He did the George Carlin show. He did a few little specials here and there. He directed some episodes of television and was pretty known for that, too. But nothing as notable as The Simpsons. But then after that, his kind of the second phase of his life, you know, in previous years, I talked about Roger Ebert, where he sort of had his rebirth thanks to social media. You know, he was certainly a well-regarded critic, and then criticism changed, and then he underwent cancer surgery, and so he literally lost his voice but found it again with Twitter. Sam sort of refound his voice or his purpose outside of Hollywood in in basically trying to do good for the world, primarily around the wellness and safety of animals. He owned a ship that was part of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society fleet. It's called the MY Sam Simon. There's also a Bridget Bardot one, and I'm trying to think what else, Bob Barker, I think. So yeah, basically, they are an organization that uses direct action tactics to protect the lives of marine mammals, which means that they forcibly insert themselves between hunters or poachers directly on the water. So they're basically, you know, there's hunters or poachers with guns, spears, harpoons, what have you, trying to kill mammals in the water, and they're inserting themselves between them. So, you know, that is certainly a worthy cause. There's, you know, some people say that they go a little bit too far, but ultimately I think it's for a good cause. He also has the Sam Simon Foundation, which is dedicated to rescuing and retraining stray dogs who would otherwise be euthanized. He owns, I think it's like 6 or 7 acres of basically the most desirable real estate on the planet in Malibu, that he just has dogs like living near waterfalls and fed, and just the most beautiful grounds that anyone or anything would live on. And it's just because he hates to see animals put down, and he wants them to have a good life. And so he has dedicated his life in his post-Hollywood career to doing good for others. In this case, it's the others of animals, and hopefully, you know, humans along the way. He was also a big poker guy. He loved poker. He participated in the World Series of Poker and actually finished in the money 6 times. And there he met his eventual wife, Jennifer Tilly, who is an actress. You would know her from Bound and quite a few other things.
I didn't know they were married.
Yep, they were married and divorced twice, and were engaged to be married again when he died on March 8th. There's a great episode of the WTF podcast, Mark Maron's podcast, where he went to Sam's house. Sam wasn't super ill, but he was ill enough that he didn't venture out a lot. And when he did, he would do it for like kind of long periods of time where he would take up residence in another country, something like that. So Mark went out to his house and just had a great conversation about all of this. And I'll link to that. It's I think it's under his paywall, but I bet you could find it elsewhere on the internet if you looked really hard. But it's a really great interview. And Jennifer Tilly's there just kind of helping him out. And you can tell the love there. It's really good. And it makes me really happy to see when people in Hollywood reach beyond those walls for good. You know, I think when you have money and influence, the best thing you can do is use said money and influence for good causes. And I'm proud of Sam for doing that. You know, he brought me joy every day with The Simpsons. I mean, I think of The Simpsons somehow every day, no doubt. And, you know, knowing that he is ultimately responsible for what I love about The Simpsons the most, about just how heartful it is, or filled with heart it is, I'm indebted to him for laughs and emotions and heart that he brought to me. So he'll be missed, both him and his causes. I'm sure, you know, his foundation will live on. He certainly did well for himself, but he as the individual will be missed.
Wow, well said, Kyle.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Gotta wipe a little tear away. We had some friends send in their thoughts on some other celebrities that we lost in the last year. We have Chris Grapp telling us about Roddy Piper.
Hello, everybody. Kyle here. Sorry to interrupt. As will sometimes happen, we had some email wires crossed, and Chris Grapp will not be talking about Roddy Piper, but rather we'll be talking about Christopher Lee. So here we go.
Christopher Lee was quite possibly the coolest person ever. He served for several years in the Special Forces of the British Royal Air Force and was a World War II veteran. Before Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen won the hearts of an adoring public for being on-screen rivals but best friends in real life, there was Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing. The two shared the screen, playing rivals, in over 20 films. Christopher Lee didn't even start acting until he was 25 and appeared in over 200 films himself. He's played Dracula, The Mummy, and Fu Manchu. He's even been a major performer in some of the all-time great film series such as Star Wars, The Lord of the Rings, James Bond, and Police Academy. He was a huge heavy metal fan. His lineage traces back to Charlemagne, the first Holy Roman Emperor, and this was the subject of 2 of Lee's heavy metal albums. He also recorded heavy metal covers for the holidays, including Little Drummer Boy, Silent Night, and Jingle Hell, which if you have not heard it, stop what you're doing, seek it out. Who can come close to being that badass? There will never be another Christopher Lee.
Allison Clotter wanted to talk about Maureen O'Hara.
The first time I encountered Maureen O'Hara on film was when I was a young kid watching E.T. You know the scene. E.T. is at home watching television and drinking beer while Elliot is at school dissecting frogs in a science class. Through some kind of mind meld, Elliot begins experiencing everything that E.T. is. This culminates in Elliot reenacting a dramatic movie kiss with one of his classmates, a mostly shot-for-shot remake of what E.T. is seeing on the screen. Those intercut scenes from The Quiet Man, as I learned years later, struck me as a child. The kiss depicted was raw and passionate and uncomfortably, well, adult. Reflecting on Maureen O'Hara's film career, the word adult comes to mind. In so many of her roles, she depicts a similar character, a grown woman with mature passion and adult heartaches, an elegant woman of steely resolve who avoids any pretense of girlishness. While this is often her character's undoing, you get the feeling that she never completely yields. Over the years, I'd encounter O'Hara again, as a stoic single mother in both Miracle on 34th Street and The Parent Trap, as Roddy McDowell's lovelorn older sister in How Green Was My Valley, and as Jimmy Stewart's wife in the bright and breezy Mr. Hobbs Takes a Vacation. She teamed again with John Wayne in the Western McClintock as his on-again, off-again, sparring wife, and her last feature film role was as John Candy's elderly mother in the criminally underrated and exceedingly charming Only the Lonely. In all of these movies, O'Hara has a vitality that is unmatched, adding depth and complexity to even a minor role. Upon viewing The Quiet Man years later, a different kiss struck me. It's not the one in E.T., in which John Wayne swings O'Hara out of the wind and into his arms, narrowly avoiding a slap from O'Hara afterward. It's later in the same scene, when O'Hara, on her way out the door, turns around and steals her own kiss from John Wayne. That's my indelible image of Maureen O'Hara on screen, of a woman who knows her own mind and who fearlessly, unapologetically, goes for what she wants.
Andy Carey is going to talk about our favorite Count Dooku, Christopher Lee.
Greetings. I'd like to talk about the legend, the late, the great, Sir Christopher Lee. Credited with over 275 acting roles, Lee is best remembered for his roles as Dracula and other classic monsters in numerous horror films, Saruman from the Lord of the Rings and Hobbit films, and Count Dooku in the Star Wars prequels. He's even played three separate characters from renditions of Sherlock Holmes, including Holmes himself. As a World War II veteran, Lee was an intelligence officer for the Long Range Desert Patrol, the pre-SAS British Special Forces. This guy fought Nazis in North Africa, completing countless missions, some of which are still classified, and even aiding in the retaking of Sicily. One of my favorite stories about Lee comes from the extended edition of The Return of the King. While shooting the death of Saruman, the script originally called for an overdramatic cry of pain as he's being stabbed in the back. And Lee says, "Hold on, that's not what being stabbed in the back sounds like." Director Peter Jackson, of course, agreed to the last-minute edit, and if you watch the scene, I think you'll see he chose wisely. He's also credited as the only member of the cast from LOTR to have met J.R.R. Tolkien. As if that weren't badass enough, when he was 88, he released his first heavy metal album, Charlemagne by the Sword and the Cross. He's the oldest metal performer and musician to ever hit the charts. Watching him in interviews or discussions from co-stars and friends, you can tell that he was a man truly dedicated to his craft. Every craft. And at all times, he presented himself as a gentleman deserving of the highest respect. He was one of the greats not only on the big screen, but in the pantheon of human beings to walk the earth.
Okay, now we're going to move on to some of our shorter picks, and we're going to start with Lee, speaking of Robert Loggia.
Thank you, Robert Loggia, who I probably know best as Frank Lopez in the 1983 Scarface with Al Pacino. He started out as Tony Montana's mentor and the guy who brings him into the drug business. And they wind up becoming enemies because Tony is a greedy bastard. But it's one of his probably most defining roles. But if you look at his extensive IMDb resume, there are multiple entries for every year. A lot of stuff on here that I've never heard of, but then just going through it again, a lot of things just sort of jogged my memory. Like he was in Princey's Honor, a few episodes of Bang the P.I., he was in Big, there was a movie called Gladiator, which was not the Russell Crowe Gladiator. This was a a movie came out in 1992 about bare knuckle boxing. And Innocent Blood, he was on an episode of Frasier. I mean, it kind of goes on and on here, but I always loved the gruff, tell it like it is characters that he always played, and they're always really great supporting characters that added a lot of nice texture to a scene. But yeah, I think he's one of my favorite character actors of all time, and it's a shame that he won't be doing any more movies or television.
He always sounded like he needed a throat lozenge.
Yeah, he did.
But he was so good at what he did.
Yeah.
It's pronounced lotions.
That was a missed, marketing opportunity.
Lozenges.
Oh, my throat is so sore. Here, have a lotion.
Have a lozenge. I love that he was always like the guy that was gruff, but was just like two kid interactions away from being like, "Dah, you got me."
Yeah,
totally. Yeah.
Just love that about him. He did that well. He could be both really rough and really, really sweet. So,
yep.
A Robert Lozen would be something you could take to make your voice gruff. It's like the opposite of a lozenge.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like lemon juice and sand.
With a bit of hot sauce in there. All right. Moving on to Kyle. Kyle, who are you going to talk about in your short round?
I'm going to talk about...
Short round, you like that?
Nice, nice. Club Obi-Wan. I'm going to talk about Vincent Bugliosi, who was born in 1934. He was first a prosecutor in L.A. He successfully prosecuted 105 out of 106 felony jury trials, including 21 murder convictions without a single loss. So that's something. That's kind of being, being a little bit on top of your game, I would say, especially in L.A., but he is best known kind of on the Hollywood side of things for prosecuting Charles Manson and the defendants from the Manson family who were accused of the 7 murders in the Tate-LaBianca families from August 9th and 10th of 1969. Manson himself was not at the murders. He basically sent his people to do so. But Bugliosi used circumstantial evidence to show that he basically was the mastermind of that. And as mastermind was quite insane. So the Manson killing certainly changed Hollywood forever. It was never truly an idyllic place in that regard, but it was really the counterculture happening for the first time. After this, the Easy Riders of the world, the who's the actor that I'm thinking of from Speed?
Not Keanu Reeves. Dennis Hopper.
Keanu Reeves. Dennis Hopper. Thank you. Dennis Hoppers of the world. That really took over. And a lot of that was due to some of this violence that occurred, in and around Hollywood. So he ultimately wrote a novel about it called Helter Skelter, which won an award for best true crime book of that year. It spawned 2 television movies, one in 1976 and one in 2004. And throughout history has been the best-selling true crime book in history with over 7 million copies sold. This one was interesting to me because I subscribe kind of on and off to a podcast called You Must Remember This. You Must Remember This is hosted by Karina Longworth, who is sort of a Hollywood historian. I don't know if she does that for a living or if she just really enjoys it. She is also the partners with Rian Johnson, who is directing episode 8, which is awesome. That has nothing to do with her other than the fact that I think it's really cool. But she does a really good job of talking about kind of the history of Hollywood. And she did a 12-part series, I think, about the Manson murders and everything around it, how it worked in Hollywood, who Sharon Tate was, who Charles Manson was, how Bugliosi came into play. It's really extraordinary podcasting and just content in general. So I'll link to sort of that series or maybe the start of that series. I would highly recommend if you have any interest in true crime, in Hollywood history, in Manson. It gets dark as the story certainly should given the truth of it. But it is really, really well done. So the podcast is called You Must Remember This. And it's, I think Charles Manson's Hollywood is the series, but it's really good. I'll link to that in the show notes. So Bugliosi died on June 6th at the age of 81. So we'll miss his writing. And, he did certainly good work as a lawyer and then ultimately telling the stories of those in his writings.
All right. That guy kind of sounded like he had the Midas touch a little bit.
Yeah. he really had it. He did a couple different, like he did a staging of a trial of Lee Harvey Oswald for one of his books that sounded really interesting. Just really, wow. Really interesting guy. Okay. Yeah.
Moving on in our short round, we're going to move on to Mark, who is going to talk about, oh, what's the king's name from Spaceballs?
Roland.
King Roland. Sorry. Not as funny as the name as Prince Valium, but let's try that again. We're going to move on to Mark. Mark is going to tell us about Dick Van Patten.
And who's Dick Van Patten?
King Roland.
Yes. Yes, he is.
Just the 8 of us? 10 of us?
Roland, Roland, Roland. He played King Roland.
Wow.
Sorry.
Yes, Dick Van Patten is a might have had one of the most consistent careers in Hollywood. You know, he started acting in the 40s. Was a comedian. Was the goofy little guy, and kind of stayed the goofy little guy for another 60 something years. He's
that's staying power right there.
Yeah, I mean his resume is chock full of sitcoms and made for TV movies and things like The Apple Dumpling Gang.
Oh, The Apple Dumpling Gang.
The stuff that was shown to me in my elementary school classroom, like on an actual reel of film taken out of the metal canister. And yeah, Dick Van Patten was that guy. But he was just so funny. I mean, there's a reason that Mel Brooks used him in pretty much every movie. It's the aforementioned King Roland in Spaceballs, and by far the best part of Robin Hood Men in Tights, where he was the abbot.
<That's right. laughs> Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah. He just stepped in and made the end of that movie worthwhile, even though the rest of the movie wasn't. Also credit to Patrick Stewart. But I don't have a lot to say about Dick Van Patten, but I'm sure... I am glad that he was around, and for as long as he was, because he was just a staple of a certain type of comedy in Hollywood, from, you know, this certainly in the 70s and 80s, but definitely before and after that, he was just always there, and he was always great.
He was great.
Thank you, Dick Van Patten.
Hear, hear.
So we should say that every night when we go to bed and we say our prayers.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Dick Van Patten.
Yes. I drop to my knees. I fold my hands. I say, thank you, Dick Van Patten.
I feel like that's a Cards Against Humanity card.
Yeah. I don't think there was any way I was getting through that line without laughing.
I was going to ask if you wanted to try it again, but I don't think we should.
No, I'm not going to be able to make it. No.
Suddenly, I just picture a little Precious Moments figurine down at the side of his bed with a little caption of it. Thank you, Dick Van Patten. Oh, man.
But really, thank you, Dick Van Patten.
Oh, now I'm going to follow that up with the solemn soundtrack composing of James Horner. Because I'm going to talk about James Horner, who sadly passed away in a plane crash this last year at the age of 61. James Horner was probably one of the best known film composers of the last two decades, and incidentally has a bit of a tie-in with my first pick of Leonard Nimoy, as James Horner did the soundtrack to Star Trek II: Wrath of Khan, which I didn't know.
Ah, I didn't know that either.
He's actually done, I mean, so James Horner is probably most well known for scoring the music for both the highest grossing movie of all time, prior to episode 7, and also the composing the best selling film score of all time. That first one being Avatar, and the second being Titanic. Both directed by James Cameron. He's actually worked with James Cameron on other films as well, including Aliens. And I want to say there was one more that I can't.
Didn't he do Gladiator? Wasn't that him?
That could be. That's Ridley Scott, though.
Which is Ridley Scott, yes.
Okay, yeah. You're going to... hold on. Now, here, someone look that up while I'm going to talk about him. But what I actually like, my favorite of his soundtracks is that of Braveheart, which he did in 1994. The whole soundtrack is very, very powerful. It's one of those soundtracks that I can listen to and very easily, I can picture the scene that it is accompanying. Similar to how I would, if I were to hear any bit of the score from the original Star Wars trilogy that John Williams composed. Now, granted, we're all Star Wars super fans, so I probably have a hyper awareness of that score. But the point is that the emotion that was in that music communicates so clearly as to what's happening in the movie. And I think that same thing happened in the soundtrack to Braveheart. There's a bit of a criticism of James Horner's music in that he both copied his own style repeatedly and also copied other style, like classical composers in a lot of his music. One thing that I think was a common or a strong theme through the Braveheart is that kind of penny whistle sound, that Scottish kind of sound. And then when you think of My Heart Will Go On from Titanic, the first thing that most of us think of is the penny whistle solo. First thing that I actually think of is when Jer did a hand pipe whistle version of that.
Yeah.
Of which I have a video and I will send it to you, Kyle, so you can link it to this file.
Please do.
Because it is amazing. So James Horner, so just you want to give it a try, Jer? James Horner, like I said, was one of probably the most successful composers of the last 25 years. It's really too bad that he passed away before his time.
His credits of the 80s and 90s are insane.
Yeah, it's really, he worked on,
I'm looking through them
a
now,
ton of things.
Couple of Star Treks, Krull, Cocoon, Commando, Aliens, yes. The Name of the Rose, American Tail, Willow, Red Heat,
yes. Glory,
Land Willow, Before wow. Time,
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids,
Field of Dreams, Glory. That's just the 80s.
But if you look at from like 1994 to 1997.
Legends of the Fall, Braveheart, Apollo 13, Jumanji, Balto, The Spitfire Grill, Courage Under Fire, Ransom, The Devil's Own, Titanic, Deep Impact, The Mask of Zorro, Mighty Joe Young, and Bicentennial Man.
That's 94 through 99.
Jeez.
Whatever. So the point is he did quite a bit. Probably, you know, similar to Stan Freberg, I think, he probably did much more than you were aware was his handiwork. So let's finish this up. Jer, tell us who you're going to talk about in your short round.
Yes, I am going to talk about Rick Dukaman. I believe that's how you pronounce his name.
I might submit Dukaman.
Dukaman.
Dukaman. Rick Dukaman.
Yep.
Sure. That sounds better. He's one of those, that guy actors of the 80s and 90s that was in a bunch of stuff. And you know he's funny because he's Canadian. He died in June. Some of his credits include Spaceballs, Die Hard, The Hunt for Red October, Gremlins 2, The Last Boy Scout, Class Act, Encino Man, Last Action Hero, and Scary Movie. He was also in Groundhog Day and The Burbs, which are the two movies that I remember him mostly from, but he was just kind of all over the place throughout the 80s and 90s in little tiny bit parts in comedies. And he always was one of those guys that when I saw him in a movie, it just made me happier that he was. Not that I wanted, you know, I never thought, man, I hope Rick's in this movie. But every time you saw him, I'm like, oh, cool, that guy's in this. And especially in The Burbs, he plays Tom Hanks' neighbor, Ray Weingartner, I believe is his name, something, and Weingartner, yes. And he makes that movie as much as Tom Hanks does, in my opinion. And he's spazzy and frenetic, but he's also clever. He's got a little bit of a physical comedian in him and just outstanding timing. That's pretty much it. He's just he's all over the place, and I will miss accidentally running into him when I watch movies.
He was actually a stand-up comic as well, and he had an HBO special, an hour-long HBO special in like 1991, and I remember I recorded that and watched it many, many times, and it's hilarious. I wish I could find it. I probably have it packed away somewhere, but it's a really good stand-up special.
His first appearance was on Star Search in 1984.
Oh, nice.
In the comedy category, he got second place behind Brad Garrett.
Really?
Oh. Funny.
Man, Ed McMahon was such a talent finder.
We probably have him to thank for most of the comedies of the 80s.
It's true.
Thank you, Dick Van Patten and Ed McMahon.
and you, Saturday Night Live and Ed McMahon.
All right.
Thank you, Canada.
That's a better way to sum it up. Thank you, Canada. Well, that does it for our In Memoriam 2015 episode. Thank you for listening. Remakers Mark is a proud member of the Mathis Hard Network. To find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast on the network, check us out at mathishard.net. There you will find show notes with links to all the people, movies, and links discussed in this episode. This information is also attached to the show file in the podcast client of your choice. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, where you can rate and review Remakers Mark, which would mean the world to us. We are both on Facebook and Twitter at username MathisHardNet, so please join in the discussion there too. Gentlemen, thank you for discussing your favorite dead celebrities. I look forward to the next time. May the Force be with you.
And also with you.